Why, over the past century, have good people repeatedly ignored mass murder and genocide? It's a profound question. I think it's a question all of us have asked ourselves over the last 20 years, 10 years, maybe even over the last 2 years. It's a difficult question, and you might imagine that it's one best left to philosophers, or perhaps to theologians. But in 2007, Dr. Paul Slovic, who is a professor of psychology and who also holds appointments in economics, who is best known for his research into risk perception, published a paper in the journal Judgment and Decision Making that attempted to answer that very question using the tools of psychological research. In that paper and in his subsequent research, he showed empirical evidence for what he has termed compassion fade. Compassion fade is a tendency to experience a decrease in empathy as the number of people in need increases. It seems counterintuitive, maybe paradoxical in many ways. Surely most of us think that we would feel more empathy when faced with dozens of people suffering than when faced with only one, let alone when faced with hundreds or thousands or even millions. And yet, Dr. Slovic's research, and a growing body of research inspired by his development of the concept of compassion fade, indicates that the diminishment of empathy and of motivation to provide aid begins as soon as the number of victims grows from 1 to 2. For example, in one experiment, in the pioneering experiment that he published on, he measured how much money people were willing to donate to a charity after learning about one child in need, about two children in need, or about 8 children in need. Compared to those who only learned about one child in need, the participants who learned about two children in need donated about 6% less. The participants who learned about 8 children in need donated about 15% less. Dr. Slovic also measured the emotional affect that people had upon learning about those 1, 2, or 8 children, both their self-reported emotions, and he also did an experiment measuring their facial movements in ways that are validated by psychologists to show compassion. And the people, and there was a drastic drop, even between the people who learned about one child and 2 children, and an even bigger drop from 2 to 8. Slovic called this phenomenon compassion fade, and he relates it to a related concept of psychic numbing. Empirical psychological research may have developed the ideas of compassion fade and psychic numbing fairly recently in the 21st century, but I don't think they would have been unfamiliar to the prophet Ezekiel, writing in the 6th century BC. His ancient words speak to us today about how God works among us, not only restoring us, but transforming us, not only as individuals, but as a community, not only for our own sake, maybe not even primarily for our own sake, but so that God's name may be honored among all people. Ezekiel is writing in the midst of a profound communal trauma, the exile. And in the midst of that trauma, he speaks of a radical change, the hard stone heart replaced by a heart of flesh. The exiles of Israel had experienced devastation, which Ezekiel attributes to their own idolatry, violence, and neglect. God promises these exiles not only a return to the land, but a return of the people to themselves. I will give you a new heart and a new spirit. God's renewing spirit breaks through our compassion fade. It disrupts our psychic numbing. It turns our hearts of stone into hearts of flesh. It's here that the connection emerges between Ezekiel's vision and what we now call compassion and self-compassion, mindful compassion. In scripture, hard hearts are infertile for the work of divine life. parts of flesh, on the other hand, can feel the pain of the other, can respond to injustice, can stand for mercy. Ezekiel calls the people to be revived, cleansed, empowered by the Spirit to walk in God's ways. When I lived in Austin, I was fortunate to become exposed to the work of Dr. Kristen Neff, another psychologist, this one at the University of Texas at Austin. She has pioneered a notion of self-compassion, which invites us to practice kindness towards ourselves as a foundation for compassion toward others. Dr. Neff defines self-compassion with three core elements. Mindfulness, that is, not over-identifying with the suffering. Common humanity, recognizing that we are not alone in our suffering. And self-kindness, as opposed to harsh self-judgment. Now, Ezekiel is speaking primarily about a corporate and communal context, but the theological truth is the same. When our hearts are softened, when we as a community can embody self-compassion and compassion, then we are prepared to serve others, to heal, to resist cruelty, to stand with the oppressed. Dr. Neff's work serves as a reminder to us. Self-compassion is not selfishness. It's the root of resilience, empathy, and moral responsiveness. So the renewed heart Ezekiel envisions is one capable of compassionate action outward because it has first experienced compassion inward. What if we treated compassion as a spiritual discipline? What if we made it a practice to extend compassion to ourselves and to those around us? What if we made ourselves do it? In our tradition, we're familiar with practices, disciplines like prayer, meditation, reading scripture. But what if we also consciously practiced mindful compassion? Pausing, noticing our own inner life, noticing the ways our hearts have hardened, inviting God to soften our hearts, giving ourselves the kindness we so easily sometimes give others, and then letting that move us into service. One simple practice for self-compassion is what Dr. Neff calls a self-compassion break. You can do it anytime things are difficult. When I practice it, I like to pause and place my hands over my heart when I take a self-compassion break. You start by affirming to yourself that the suffering you are experiencing is real. You might say to yourself, "This is a moment of real suffering," or "This hurts," or just "ouch." You then remind yourself of our common humanity. I sometimes say, "I'm not alone in this," or "We all struggle in our lives," or "Other people feel this way." And finally, you ask yourself, "What do I need to hear to express kindness to myself?" Sometimes that's, "May I be strong," or "May I forgive myself," or "May I be brave." Sometimes it's just reminding myself, "I am loved." For our community, this movement from self-compassion to outward compassion becomes a discipline of justice, noticing our own bias, our own pain, our own complicity, giving ourselves grace in the face of all those things, then standing in solidarity with those suffering mass violence, displacement, discrimination. It ties directly into Ezekiel's vision. A God-given heart of flesh that feels deeply, acts boldly, and becomes the field in which seeds of transformation are planted. And I think we need to be honest with ourselves that a hard heart is tempting sometimes. It can feel like armor that we put on to protect ourselves from the slings and arrows that a cruel world so often directs at us, or that we pick up when standing in front of other people. When I was reading the scripture, I couldn't get out of my head a song by Cher from 1989, "Heart of Stone." "Don't you sometimes wish that your heart was made of stone? Mercy, mercy, wish your heart was a heart of stone. And yes, I do sometimes wish that. Sometimes I think we all wish that. We look around and we see so much suffering, suffering in our own lives, suffering around the corner in our community, suffering everywhere in our nation, everywhere in our world. Treasured relationships end. Beloved friends and family grow sick and die. Our bodies remind us of our own frailty. Our leaders bicker and blame and benefit themselves while the rest of us suffer. Housing is becoming more and more expensive, and yet our leaders from both parties respond by arresting or institutionalizing unhoused people. The climate crisis is already taking lives and displacing communities, while we blithely debate whether or not it's a hoax. A bit of compassion fade, a bit of psychic numbing, a harder heart seems awfully tempting when compared to bearing the weight of all the suffering and pain we can feel helpless to eat. And that's understandable. And yet the scriptures from Ezekiel to the Psalms to Luke have staunch words for those of us who close our hearts to the suffering around us. But the staunch words are not the final word. The good news is that Ezekiel's promise is that God refuses to leave us with hearts of stone. God promises to act, to give us new hearts and new spirits, not so that we can feel good about ourselves, not so that we can congratulate ourselves about how empathetic and compassionate we are, but so that we can be participants in God's work of renewal and justice. Compassion is not just an emotion, but a vocation. It is the Spirit's call to resist the cruelty and apathy that saturate our age. When we allow God to soften our hearts, when we beg God to replace our hearts of stone with soft, tender hearts of flesh, we begin to resist the normalization of cruelty that defines so much of our public life today. From the ongoing and ceaseless assaults on immigrants and asylum seekers, to policies that strip away the dignity of the poor, the unhoused, and the marginalized. From political violence and polarization, to real acts of violence in our own communities and in every corner of the globe. To have a heart of flesh in such a time is not a weakness, it is resistance. Compassion is strength. Empathy is courage. When Jesus blesses the poor, the hungry, the ones who weep, the ones who are hated in the Beatitudes, he is naming the very people through whom God's kingdom breaks into history. People whose hearts have been made tender, who feel the pain in their own lives and in the lives of others, and dare to act on it. And so let us be such a people. Let us be those who feel deeply, who love boldly, who refuse to grow numb. May we nurture compassion as our daily practice and as our holy defiance. In a world that keeps trying to turn hearts to stone, every act of mercy is a miracle, and every softened heart is a sure sign of the resurrection and the life to come.